I suppose it was bound to happen at some point this season. At some point, the lessons I've learned from Godless were bound to connect to something else important in my story. There are a few things in life we don't get to choose. Things like family, the place where we're born, and the things that influence us during important seasons of our lives. Some things just move into our space, interrupt our thought patterns and rhythms just long enough for us to take notice. Then, they stick. Godless has been one of those things for me. But it isn't the first Western that's done this. The first was in 1997, 4 years after it was released and I finally got around to watching it. Tombstone. What a movie. To this day, when I get into a situation that feels cinematic, I quote a line from it. I'm your Huckleberry. I've got two guns, one for each of you. Listen, Mr. Kansas Law Dog, law don't go around here, savvy? Calm down, wait a minute, listen to me. I stand corrected, Wyatt, you're an oak. He's down by the creek, walking on water. Of all the lines, all the moments in this movie that caused me to stop and take an assessment of my life at the time, it was the pivotal moment when Doc Holliday is lying in his bed, too sick to help Wyatt face Ringo, that shook me. Wyatt asked a question that I didn't fully understand at the time. I was only 17. But now, just a few weeks from 40, it's one that's haunted me. It should haunt all of us. Wyatt, he's staring out the window at a ranch, and he asks Doc, "What makes a man like Ringo, Doc? What makes him do the things he does?" Doc answers through a sick cough. "A man like Ringo has got a great big empty hole right through the middle of him. He can never kill enough, steal enough, or inflict enough pain to ever fill it." See, our actions, they have motivations. And most of the time, those motivations are internal. Internal, not external. There have been times in my life where I wanted to take my actions and make them a result of something someone else has done. As men, we're really good at finger pointing, and our anger really helps us be really good at this. It's tempting for all of us as men to play the blame game. This started, as far as we've been told, all the way back in the garden. That first time a man was caught in a situation he didn't like. He blamed the woman. But you know, Doc's right. The things we do are largely based on the things we have or don't have internally. This way of thinking about a man is empty, it's actually ancient. Every civilization since the start of the human timeline has had ways of talking about it. And this brings us back to Godless, to talk about a character we haven't said much about until now, Sheriff Bill McNew. Throughout the series, he made it his mission to catch up with Frank and administer justice. He's the detective, the law, and he's going blind. It's an unfortunate twist of fate for a man whose job was watching the town. How do you shoot a bad guy if you can't see him coming? It's obvious from the start that the sheriff is struggling with this disadvantage and is attempting to hide it from everyone. There's a certain way men do this, actually. They deny it's happening at all. It's a dangerous play with flimsy logic, but we do it anyway. We do it because it makes us feel better. While investigating the famous shootout chase details in episode 7, the sheriff has an encounter with a mysterious Shoshone Indian and his dog. The exchange is typical and it's comical. This guy is one of my favorite characters because he reminds me a lot of myself. Knowing that something has to be done, setting out to do it, and fumbling all along the way because of a physical limitation. I feel this way a lot, but that's a topic for another day. As soon as he notices the Indian watching his investigation of the scene, he climbs the side of a small hill to get a close enough look and to have a civil conversation. The Shoshone starts by saying, "It was over before it started." I instantly knew what he meant. I've been in too many fights of my own that could have been described that way. It's an incredible exchange between these two men. But something happens at the end of the conversation that changes the temperature. The older Indian sets himself up as the sage. He says to the sheriff, "You lost your shadow." And then he rides off, just like that. He sees straight through the sheriff. He sees the great big hole right through the middle of him. He sees why the sheriff is even out there in the first place. The reason why he's on a journey for justice when he can barely see enough to examine the evidence. His motivation, shrouded in the external fact of a crime, was actually based on an internal need. It's no stretch to say that most of us, we haven't been given the roadmap for how to navigate the things that are driving us, our motivations. The only thing we know for sure is that something strong is driving us. Something, it seems, we don't have any control over. I'll never forget the moment that this fact was sealed in my story. I was in ninth grade, and we were playing our crosstown rival in basketball. Yes, it was junior high, but the games were intense. We had been trained long enough in the language of hate to know that every game, no matter the age of the participants, mattered against this team. Even the high schoolers would show up to watch. If you want to turn up the intensity of a moment for a junior high male, just drop him into a competitive environment fueled by rivalry with high school females watching. I can still smell the gym that night. Popcorn, athletic tape, the wood floor, and the sweat. Toward the end of the first half, the pace of the game was picking up. We were simply trading baskets. Both teams were actually playing well. It was the type of game we expected. I played the post that night, actually most nights. I was too slow to play anything else. Defensively, I was having a great game against a guy who hit puberty at 8 and looked more like an older uncle than a guy in our grade. It was all going well. I was proud of my efforts until it happened. There was a shot that fell to my side of the rim. I blocked out, just as I had been taught. I secured the rebound, and I turned to see Jim Morrison calling for an outlet. Not the guy from the Doors, an actual guy in my class, who was a starting point guard. I remember his face was red, and he was yelling. He wanted to start the fast break. He was quick and a great ball handler. He knew how to run an offense. And I knew it was my job to get the ball to him. But I didn't. What I did instead, I can't even explain. I have no idea why it even crossed my mind. Right there, in my home gym, with my girlfriend watching, with my parents watching, I turned around and jumped to shoot at the wrong goal. I was that guy. The only thing I could think when I was in the air was, it's the wrong goal. You can't take this shot. So I did the only thing I thought I could do at the time. I threw the ball as hard as I could against the glass, hoping it would make its way back to Jim. It didn't. The guy I was guarding, Will Overstreet, he saw what was happening, and he hung back. He grabbed the rebound of the shot that I took at his goal, and he laid it up for 2. I wanted to disappear, literally disappear, under the gym floor. It was, to that point, the most embarrassing thing I had done at school. My coach, he actually didn't take me out. As terrible as the shot was, he needed me in the game. I kept playing, but I wasn't mentally there. All I could think about were those times I had seen football players run the wrong direction with the entire stadium attempting to stop them. Idiots. Now I was that idiot, and everyone I saw on a daily basis was there to see it. I was Bill Buckner, you know, the guy who missed the ground ball at first base and let the Mets force a game 7. History doesn't remember Bill for his over 1,000 runs scored, or the fact that he has an impressive 22-season career in the majors, one of which he was an all-star. Nope. We remember the ground ball, the mistake. That night, that moment, blew a great big hole right through the middle of me. That's what moments like that do. They're violent. And as a result, they become the internal motivator we don't like talking about. I actually don't remember how the game ended up that night, but I do remember what my coach said to me at halftime. I'm not sure how he found the words or why he didn't bench me for the rest of the night, even if he did need me. I'm just thankful he did what he did in that small locker room in Jackson, Mississippi. I was sitting on a stool trying to disappear when he walked in the door. The team got quiet, and he looked straight at me. "That was the first half," he said. "It's 2 points, and it's over now." And that was it. That night, David Blunt gave me back my shadow. This event isn't the first thing I talk about at parties when people ask me to tell them a little more about myself. Yeah, it's still embarrassing, but it doesn't run me like it should. I've lost my shadow a few other times since then. I've been tempted to live like the sheriff in the desert, but more often than not, there's another man there who's determined to give me back my shadow. We do a lot of talking at the hangar about having a group of men that know you, that can peg you when life has taken something from you, when you shoot at the wrong basket with all your friends watching. Here are the facts. At some point in the future, you're going to lose your shadow. At that moment, you will either be on a course to become a Ringo or a Frank, but you can't let that happen. You have to become very aware of what's motivating you internally, and you have to ask for help. And if you started to live like a hangman, you'll have plenty of men around you to give you your shadow back.